and there is sort of a war on the streets between government factions who are ostensibly working for the aliens to break up rebel alliances. I'm just speaking in Star Wars terms. Welcome to the second episode of the relaunched MacGuffin podcast. With me is my co-host from San Diego, California, Keith Foster.
I'm glad you remembered because I forgot already. With me is Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Yes. Yes, that is me. That is us. That is this podcast. And I just want to say to everybody out there who came along the ride for last week's episode one or episode, 1.5, whatever you want to call it. I'm really happy. I think it went well. I was really happy with just sort of the general reception of the podcast, sort of the enthusiasm around the release of it. Everybody thinks we're famous now, and I'm okay with that. Dude, I'm going to ride that for a while.
Stop it. Don't tell them our secrets. Did you learn nothing from The Secret?
I guess not. No.
The whole point is it's about like putting positive energy out and altering. It's about lying. It's about lying to yourself so that your reality becomes what you want it to become.
Right.
So
it's about delusions of grandeur in some sort of weird hippie new agey religion.
It's about deluding yourself enough to where either good things actually start to happen or you believe them. But either way, does it matter? Because it's real to you. So why are you ruining the magic?
I'm not ruining the magic. I did want to say, I think there are some people who maybe listen to the show who haven't before, or people who are just joining on right now, and I'm really happy about that. And
for all of you people, we are ultra famous sex gods.
So famous, so important. And today we're going to be talking about movies. We are talking about Captive State, which is a movie I barely knew existed until a couple days ago. And at the end of the show for our Netflix homework, which I assigned you, we are going to be talking about Steven Soderbergh's, I think, 2010, 2011 release, The Informant.
2009.
Oh my God. I'm old then because I reviewed that movie for my YouTube show a million years ago.
Oh, okay. So you've seen this.
Yes. Yes. Which is one of the reasons I kind of wanted to assign it to you, is because I remember feeling a certain way about it 10 plus years ago. And I wondered if I would feel the same way. But
yeah.
We got a lot of things here at the top of the show. One thing we like to encourage listeners to do is engage us in feedback. Mostly the feedback we do receive, and I'm very appreciative of it, is from friend of the show, Patrick, who I've been on his show, Almost Educational. He's been on our show off and on. He might be coming on again here soon. But he wanted to follow up on last week's episode with his thoughts on Captain Marvel and our review of it. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
Hi, Patrick here. I'm going to insinuate myself in your podcast again. I'm going to go 2 for 2 in March. Hopefully I'll go 3 for 3 at the end here. But I just want to weigh in on Captain Marvel. Now, this is pulling back the curtain of me listening to your podcast for the past 5 years or so. I find myself only agreeing with Cassie about 30% of the time. Most times I find his film snobbery disgust me, and I'm just kidding. But like, I don't find myself agreeing with him often, which is part of the reason I enjoy the show. And I do enjoy that Keith has encyclopedic knowledge of comic books like I do. I was very disappointed in you, Keith. Usually, like, Cassie will fumble through, like, he Wikipedia'd some Marvel stuff and pretend like he knows what he's talking about. And I'll mix up, like, X-Men cartoons from the 90s and, like, X-Men Chris Claremont canon. And I can just feel the desperation through the podcast coming through for him to be, like, an expert in music and film and all media. But he's right. He's right this week. I threw away all my notes. It's like a noir. It was great that it was not like a linear told origin story. It was chopped up. It was told differently. She was underplayed. Brie Larson underplayed Captain Marvel. She made herself seem alien. It was wonderful. It was so much better than I expected. I don't watch any trailers going into this at all. I don't understand how this is not viewed as like a top tier Marvel movie. I think maybe because people are just waiting for Avengers Endgame to come about and they don't care about this. But if this came out like 4 years ago, people would go ballistic for it. That said, I had thoughts. If this was like set in 1985, like a decade earlier than it is, and it had more of a Cold War feel of like the end of the Cold War and the Skrulls were being tracked by S.H.I.E.L.D. and there's like this idea of maybe the Kree are involved or maybe it's the Soviets too. We don't really know. Would that have made the film a little more, I don't know, palatable for like audiences? I feel like the 1995 thing just rang hollow for me. And I think for a lot of people in my audience too who groaned at like the Nine Inch Nails shirt and the Garbage song and stuff. Maybe that's just me.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. Shade, first of all.
No. I liked what he said about almost always agreeing with me.
Last episode.
Yeah, well, I mean, I will fully admit that Captain Marvel is one of those characters that is just, she's always sort of been in my blind spot. So, you know, there's so many comic books out there. You cannot keep up with all of them.
No.
And she was sort of a later one who was mired in mystery, and she just always seemed sort of impenetrable to me.
Right.
So, like, I've read some stuff of her, but I don't know her, like, mythology and mythos. I do like Patrick's idea of having it set in the 80s instead of
the
90s. I think maybe there's just a little more culturally that that maybe they could have drawn on instead of just what sort of felt like playing for nostalgia. But
right. But I wonder if we feel that way because we grew up in the 90s. And I'm counting Patrick as part of this. We're kind of 90s kids for the most part. Patrick's a little bit older than us, but not by much. And I think that those cultural pop culture references that they touch on and kind of use as like timestamps in the movie. We cringe a little bit more at those because we were there when those things happened and that was part of our pop culture experience. Whereas even just 10 years before that, we might have adopted those pop culture experiences, but we didn't come up with them in the same way. So it was always sort of a point of nostalgia for us.
Maybe. I don't know. I feel, and my wife kind of felt this way too, is that they could have incorporated the decade a little bit more rather than just like it's young Nick Fury. And I do agree with what he was saying about how, you know, like sort of the Cold War era, there is stuff that could have tied in thematically as well as setting it as a period piece. So,
sure.
So yeah. I like that idea personally.
I like that he agreed with me more than you. But I think it's funny he says that, that you know, for the most part, he agrees with you more than me and that it's like a 30-70% kind of thing. When last week's episode was what seemed like the first time in a long time that we've had any kind of like substantive disagreement.
Yeah.
Even though our letter grade was like maybe like a 0.5 different.
Yeah, it's true. And especially with a Marvel movie, usually on any kind of pop culture-y, big blockbuster thing, I tend to skew a little more positive and you tend to skew a little more critical. And you know what? I do want to point out one thing to Patrick. that I do think he's correct. If this movie had come out, you know, say 10 years ago,
yeah,
we would hold it up more. But I think that's it. It's coming out now, not 10 years ago. You know, we have 10 years of origin stories. So I don't know. I don't know.
I feel and maybe Patrick agrees with me, I feel like time is going to be favorable to Captain Marvel. I think people, especially as we see her in more movies and stuff, I think people are going to look back and be like, you know what? That one's actually kind of cool. But we'll see.
I don't know. Speaking of Marvel, do we want to get this out of the way now?
Well, we might as well. Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny, again, because last week we talked a great deal about James Gunn doing the...
I wish I just had a soundboard, because I would just start, like, blasting The Chain by Fleetwood Mac right now. Edit that in to the episode.
Okay. I guess. Yeah, so I think that, you know, we talked about a lot last week about him doing moving over to DC and doing the Suicide Squad movie, and then, like, you know,
this news is so bananas I can't even set it up. James Gunn is back, baby.
Yes,
back to Guardians 3. He is officially slated as the director. Apparently. There are rumors that say Marvel never even looked elsewhere.
Yeah,
I'm sure they had to give it time to die down.
Right.
I'm sure they had to do a background check to make sure that, you know, like, these are just jokes.
Yeah, that there's nothing insane going on. Which makes me wonder, actually. So I'll read the official quote here that I pulled out of this article on Deadline. Marvel Studios has agreed to commence production with Guardians of the Galaxy 3 after Gunn completes Suicide Squad 2, making the whole thing easier. Making the whole thing easier, though, was the fact that Marvel Studios never met or considered any other director for Guardians of the Galaxy 3. So we already knew that they were going to use James Gunn's script. That was always kind of a thing. I guess there was always sort of the possibility that if they were to hire another director who maybe liked writing or cared at all about what was in the script, he could have had a pass on it, and then he would have had multiple writing credits. But it seems – now I'm wondering, in my conspiratorial brain, was there ever going to be another director? Was this just like the biggest – hype game of all time?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think maybe, but you know what? It fucking worked. This news made my day. I was genuinely having kind of a shitty day.
For sure.
And somebody shared this with me like the second it dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple people shared it with me, actually, like the second it dropped. Because I have very personal investment in these movies at this point. A lot of people do.
The Guardians movies or all the Marvel movies in general?
Specifically the Guardians movies. There's just something about them, like, stand out even beyond sort of the general MCU-ness, which I do love.
Yeah.
But there's just something special there. Also, it's incredible that we're still getting his Suicide Squad, and another report that's come out since. I can't cite my source, unfortunately, because just Google it. I'm sure you'll find it. But they're saying that his Suicide Squad's going to be a reboot. It's not going to be a sequel. So
okay,
it's going to be James Gunn's Suicide Squad. He gets kind of a carte blanche of his roster of characters. Like, they're just giving it to him.
Wow.
And I am here for it.
Yeah, you know, I saw another article, and I thought the headline was cheesy as fuck, but it said, is James Gunn going to unite the DC and Marvel fandoms?
Oh my god, if James Gunn brought us a DC versus Marvel and amalgam universe,
yeah.
If he created
a peace pact between the two rival gangs of DC versus Marvel, then he should run for president.
Right? Jesus.
One of the reasons why we were so invested in seeing James Gunn stay with Marvel, be able to do this, is because it was kind of, you know, especially if you've been a fan of his filmography before he was involved with Marvel, and comes from, you know, the trauma school and working his way up through kind of cult horror films and that kind of stuff, and, you know, writing stuff like Scooby-Doo movies for a long time and whatever. Mm. It was kind of like he was one of us. Like, the whole, like, series is about the Guardian series is all about sort of the outsiders kind of becoming the hero, and it sort of mirrored his own story as, you know, being this sort of culty fringes of Hollywood figure into what is the biggest thing in Hollywood right now, which is Disney Marvel. And to see him kind of get kicked out of that, it sort of just proved this is like a shitty, like, system where the weirdos aren't allowed anymore.
It felt very corporatized. It felt very, exactly. It felt very cold and cynical and just
like, of course the guy who made Slither is going to get kicked out.
Yeah. And that isn't to, you know, to say that they didn't have legitimate reasons. I think they did. But I'm glad they've realized it's a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very excited for what the future holds.
For sure.
All
good
super
news.
Pumped.
We're really happy about that one. We didn't really plan on movie news this week, but we decided to talk about this just because, well, one, we talked about last week, and because people are pretty excited.
Yeah, and we've been so invested in the story, and it's
right.
It's crazy to see Disney, I don't want to say back down, but to reverse a decision. You know?
Right.
That is what's sort of crazy. The biggest entertainment company in the world. That's fucking cool.
Right. All right. Well, what we do have here at the front of the show is a listener survey. And we posted this on our Facebook page. You should be following us there if you aren't already. Facebook.com/MacGuffinPod. And we, you know, this is where we post all of our news stories
Did you post this one on Twitter?
I didn't, because we got so many responses on Facebook that we were okay. We didn't really need to do that. Normally I would as well, but this one, by the time I even checked it on Facebook, I was like, oh, we're good. So I didn't actually double dip into Twitter, but follow us on Twitter as well, at MacGuffinPod. But here on Facebook, if you follow us here, you'll see when we post these kind of listener questions, and we're going to go through these here. There was a thing, I think it was Joseph Gordon-Levitt posted from his Twitter account, what movie makes you laugh every time you watch it? We thought it was a good enough question to pose to our listeners.
Yeah.
And we got a decent amount of opinions on this. So do you want to take a stab at some of these answers?
Sure, yeah. I'll just go down my list here.
Okay.
Diana Falcon says Zoolander.
Yeah.
I remember it. This was one that kind of warmed on me a little after time. Like, I remember the first time I saw it, I was kind of like, all right. There were moments that made me shit my pants. Like the gasoline fight and the moisture is the essence of wetness kind of stuff. But I think as a whole, like the first time I saw it, I felt like the gag got a little tired near the end. And maybe it still does. But it does, I think, like most Ben Stiller movies, it has few moments of just pure comedic brilliance.
So Zoolander is actually kind of a funny thing, because I think it's sort of a cult comedy hit. Like, people basically know what Zoolander is, and it's very quotable. People talk about it a lot, but I don't think a lot of people know that it originated as a sketch, very short interstitial sketches that would appear on VH1's like fashion awards that they used to do in the late 90s.
I didn't know that.
Oh, really? Yeah, this is like something they only did like maybe for 3 years, when high fashion was kind of rock star and cool or whatever, and like DJs would be there and whatever. So yeah, I think Ben Stiller hosted 1 year or something like that, and the Zoolander character was something he invented, and it would just play in between you know, different awards that they gave out. And then he expanded it into the Zoolander movies. I never saw the sequel, but I still quote the first one quite a bit, actually. And I said this is one of the first comedies where made a Will Ferrell sort of a thing outside of SNL.
Was this before Anchorman?
Oh, yeah. This came out in, like, 2001. Like, we were still in high school.
Yeah, it was 2001. When I guess Anchorman was more like
2003 or 4.
Oh, yeah. Oh, shit. Because in my head, I kind of lump those movies together because they are sort of a generation of sort of new comedians.
Right.
Sort of taking over Hollywood.
Right.
Not that Ben Stiller, like, hadn't been around, but you know what I mean.
Or going from television into film in a big way. Yeah.
Also, we're taking too long.
Way too long. What's the next one? And you're reading them in a very weird order, so I'm going to have to go from you from now on.
My order is the order I see them in. Alyssa Jean Witty says, Airplane, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and Thor Ragnarok. I know it's an unconventional answer, but goddamn it, it's funny.
Sure is.
I agree with all of those. Airplane is... It's not necessarily a type of humor I seek out because it's very joke heavy. It's very it doesn't depend on setting up a reality, really making you believe these characters. It's
a series of gags.
Yeah, and it's but as far as that kind of total parody joke machine farce movie goes, it's hard to find better of that genre.
I probably appreciate that movie now more than I did when I was younger and it was on TV all the time.
It was sort of, it was one of the first movies to just operate as a lewd joke machine the way Airplane does.
Sure. Of course, these are all like comedy classics. What's another one?
Dave Lindsay, Young Frankenstein. That's up there for me.
Mm-hmm.
What's Up, Doc? Gregory's Girl and Tempopo.
Are those all the same person?
Yeah, those are all from Dave Lindsay.
Okay. Okay.
I don't know any of those except Young Frankenstein, but that's a classic.
Yeah.
Andrew Goodwine, he has Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Barrera, Girls Trip.
That's a new one. Probably the newest one on here.
But yeah, my wife saw it and she loved it. Brianna Allen says Joe Dirt, Super Troopers, and Dodgeball. Dodgeball was another one of those ones. It came out a little bit later than like Anchorman and stuff, but it to me is sort of that same generation.
Sure. Yeah, and that's still on my list of shame. I've never seen Dodgeball.
See, Dodgeball, I've seen the other two. Dodgeball is also very quotable, but it's not as like hilarious. But it's so much as just like really entertaining. Like it's just a fun. Like I don't necessarily laugh out loud when I watch it, but it's like comfort food. You know what I mean?
Yeah, people like it, and it gets quoted fairly often, and all of that stuff.
You can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
Right. There was like a weird little period of time, kind of around this period of time, where I didn't see as many comedies because I was like watching weird. You know, like I was watching movies like Blue Velvet and Rec Room for a Dream, and I was like kind of in that vortex. So I missed a lot of like that era.
Yeah, I worked at a movie theater when this came out, so I was all about it.
Mm-hmm.
That was like sort of a like little mini renaissance for comedy for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, those movies are still quite popular. Super Troopers I saw in high school. And, I mean, that's a...
Sequel's not so good.
Yeah, as I've heard.
In fact, most of these have sequels and they're terrible.
Well, there's a whole conversation to be had about comedies and comedy sequels.
Hillary Stevens says Hot Fuzz, my favorite movie.
Mm-hmm.
Anchorman and another vote for Young Frankenstein.
Yes.
And Ted Bondman echoes that with Hell Yeah, Hot Fuzz. Hot Fuzz is by far my favorite of the Cornetto trilogy. I love Hot Fuzz.
I don't know about by far, but I do like it a lot.
It's definitely my favorite, hands down. In Anchorman, that one is on my list for sure. Like, I know I will laugh if I watch that movie.
That's a movie I think it's funnier the more I watch it. And I think that's the test of this question. Is like, the first time I saw Zoolander, or the first time I saw Anchorman, or the first time I saw any of these movies for the most part, they were funny, but I basically was like, well, you know, that was like a breezy afternoon kind of experience. Sure, and then you see it on TV and you're like, oh, I remember this part, and you start laughing more. Then you see it again 2 years later and you're like, I love this movie.
I remember Anchorman might be one of the movies that I have laughed the hardest in theater. Like, I remember not being able to breathe.
Wow. I
loved it. It was one of those ones that we saw as like a high school outing, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's also like, you know, you have Will Ferrell, Steve Carell, Paul Rudd, like,
oh yeah, it's a who's who of everybody who wouldn't matter in comedy.
It's just a murderer's row of comedic talent, and they're all at sort of like their prime too.
Yeah,
it's just so fucking good. All right, Justin Medor says Paddington 2. I don't think it was laugh out loud hilarious, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
John Murillo, Blazing Saddles, and The Grinch.
Mm-hmm. Another Grinch Mel Brooks movie.
And The Grinch is one of my wife's favorite Christmas movies.
Now, are we talking about the Jim Carrey Grinch?
Yeah, I'm sure it's the Jim Carrey one. Yeah.
Okay. I think that John and your wife are two very different ages, so I was going to say, I think that's a generational thing. Like a movie like Hook, where if you were above a certain age, you hate it.
He had kids that would have been
the right age
appropriate to see it at the time.
Yeah.
And there are people, my wife is one of them, that like that's their
Christmas
definitive
movie.
Version of the Grinch. Like that's their Grinch. So,
interesting.
I don't know. John, if you're listening, we might need a little clarification on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the only one that's really sold as a comedy. I don't know if you'd call the cartoon specifically a comedy. Blazing Saddles is great, obviously.
Yes. Yeah. So good. Ashley Nicole says Twilight. Just kidding. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Yes.
I think that's my favorite Christmas movie.
That's definitely my favorite vacation movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Hands down. It's
not even close, really.
No, I mean,
there's a few that I like. I'm even kind of a Vegas Vacation apologist, but
no need. I think it holds up.
That's but Christmas Vacation, I think, is like the least controversial to say is your favorite.
It's got such good stuff in it.
Right.
Brad Page, another for Airplane.
Okay.
He also says it's a mad world.
Mm-hmm.
And Duck Soup.
So yes.
Another Marx Brothers.
Yes.
I might, you know, I should go back and check out some old Marx Brothers. I went through like a Three Stooges phase
when I was younger.
Seth Simmons says Tommy Boy. Yeah, I mean, Chris Farley at his peak right there.
Mm-hmm.
The Princess Bride and Groundhog Day.
Those are all great.
Solid list.
Groundhog's Day is like low-key sad. Like, I saw that kind of
later.
Yeah,
but it also has such good gags. Too.
No, yeah, it's funny. And you know, some people have called it a perfect film and whatever. But I saw it kind of later in life. And I thought it was like profoundly depressing. Like,
I mean, yes.
For a lot of it.
It's.
But I do get that, it's really funny and stuff, too.
It's also life-affirming. And I was actually having this conversation the other day. Is this the first movie to do the Groundhog Day thing?
Oh, you mean like somebody wakes up and the same situation's happening again?
Yeah, because that's kind of coming, like, that's kind of a genre that's getting done a lot right now. There's like Russian Doll and the Happy Death Day movies. Mm-hmm.
Edge of Tomorrow, which is getting a sequel.
Yeah, There have been episodes of like Supernatural that do the Groundhog right. Day thing. And they usually like reference Groundhog Day somehow. So I'm just genuinely curious if anyone knows.
I'm sure there was I'm sure there was some Twilight Zone or Outer Limits episode that did it a long time ago. I don't know. I don't have a reference point, but or some short story or something.
Okay. Just a couple more to get through here. A few more. Rachel Lee says The Princess Bride and 50 First Dates. Mm-hmm.
And I believe that Joseph Gordon-Levitt, when he originally posted this on Twitter, said that Princess Bride was his answer. And 50 First Dates actually has a little bit of that Groundhog's Day structure as well.
Yeah, kind of. It kind of does.
Yeah.
Todd Flatland says The Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm. Good answer.
That's a good one. That also has some kind of, I don't know, sadder moments. Or more real moments, I guess.
Sure.
Andrew Goodwine, another for Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Do I need to see Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
Have you never seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
I've never seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
It's been a long time since I have, and to be totally honest, it's been so long since I've seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Pee-wee's Big Top that I'm probably confusing or conflating the two movies in my head as far as what scenes were in what movie.
Yeah.
So it's probably worth looking at again. Maybe we'll see if it pops up on something before Dumbo comes out.
Yeah, yeah. Tiffany Fief Briscoe says, what about Bob? Bill Murray is just a treasure.
Everyone's mom's favorite movie.
Yes, but I think with good reason.
Yeah.
I think of Bill Murray, I think this might be his funniest movie or his funniest role.
Right.
The
interesting thing about What About Bob and Bill Murray being in it is it's not the typical Bill Murray character, because usually Bill Murray is the smartest guy in the room in every movie mm-hmm. he's in. And usually he's kind of like, his whole thing is he's like, huh, I'm a, you know, sort of above it or whatever. And that's sort of like, he's sort of like winking back at the audience, like, look at these clowns. Whereas in What About Bob, he has zero self-awareness.
Yeah.
And so it's a great Bill Murray performance, but it's also a very atypical one.
Yeah, that's true. And that's probably why it kind of stands out.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have that sort of jaded detachment.
Right.
He is so like genuinely sick and joyful at the same time.
Yeah.
It's pretty fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, last one here, Adam Clegg says Dogma.
Yeah, that was the first Kevin Smith movie I saw. I saw it on cable, and I saw that at a very weird, I guess somewhat weird time in my life, because I was a young teenager sort of going through my own existential what is religion stuff.
And so Kevin Smith played at that time heavily to the young little edgelords in our hearts that exist within all teenage boys.
Well, I don't want to go that far. I think that he's wrestling with stuff genuinely in that movie, and that comes through in the narrative. But it's also, I think, is joke for joke one of his funnier movies, because there is a greater purpose to the stuff, to the jokes. There's more of a context than other than just being gross for the sake of being gross. And I actually think it still stands up as one of his best.
Totally agree with you on that one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So those are all of our listener answers. Thank you guys for submitting.
Yes.
Now I'm going to turn this over to you, Cassidy. What's a movie that makes you laugh whenever you watch it?
Todd stole my answer, and it is The Big Lebowski. That is the gun to my head favorite comedy. I think it is always hilarious. It is so quotable. Every single scene has a great setup and punchline to it, without it seeming like every single scene is set up to do just that. It's also pushing the story forward in an interesting way. I just think it's the Coen brothers at their like zany, goofy gear at their best
for sure
doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to be mad at that.
So many
that
great
answer.
Performances all the way through. I and it's one of those movies, like the 7th, 8th, 9th time you see it, you start to like have new favorite stuff in it. You're like, my favorite thing in this movie now is like Flea as one of the nihilists. Or
I love all of the nihilists.
Yes.
But yes. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why this movie had kind of a resurgence as like a college dorm movie. It's
right, stoner film and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's great. There's people on my timeline who literally post a meme that it's the 10th already or the 15th or whatever. I'm sure I'm getting the actual quote wrong.
Oh, right. The rent thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, even just seeing that meme tickles me a little bit. I mean, it's a great movie. I should put that on rotation more. All right. And for me, honestly, there's a lot on here that are on my list. I think Thor Ragnarok is you know, probably a modern classic. Also, you know, I want to give another shout out to a modern movie. Another Taika Waititi, What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, that's really funny. I haven't seen it since I saw it in theater, but that was such a delight and a surprise when I went and saw that pretty much by myself at like an 11 o'clock showing in Long Beach.
Yeah, I saw this with my friend Ted. We were at the Phoenix Improv Festival and we had an afternoon off and we just went and saw it. And I loved it. It's just so quirky and funny. And then I've seen it a couple times since, and it holds up. It's so good. And it's one of those ones, too, that, like, after you know some of the bigger jokes,
yeah,
you see it again and you can appreciate smaller moments.
Sure.
So it definitely rewards rewatching. But honestly, there's so many. I love comedy, Cassidy. I love it.
I know.
I want to shout out to Harold and Kumar. That one, I might laugh a little less than the first time I saw it, but my big dog, Hillary Stevens, nailed it. Anchorman.
Okay. I thought you were going to say Hot Fuzz, but...
No, I love Hot Fuzz, but as far as like just comedy makes me laugh out loud every time I see it is Anchorman.
Yeah.
No matter how many times it gets quoted at me, it just makes me happy. It's just such a solid damn comedy.
Yeah. You know, thinking back, I think maybe the only comedy that I watch annually, like there's certain movies I will definitely see at least once a year. And I think of all of those, even probably more than Big Lebowski, which is my gun to my head favorite comedy officially, but I've probably seen Wayne's World more.
Yo, yeah. Fuck, how did I not mention
that? And that's
that?
A movie yeah. I probably, quote, inadvertently, at least once a week.
Yeah, that's a good one. let's move on. This is just...
We could talk about this for a long time, and I think that I really like these answers, and it has nothing to do with any of the movies we're talking about today.
No. Not at all.
But I enjoyed this survey. So, look out on our Facebook, facebook.com/ MacGuffin Pod.
No, you must never speak the old name again.
To see when we post these survey questions. All right, let's talk about movies. And we'll start here with this week's main review, Captive State.
Do you want me to set this one up, or
I got it. I literally just walked out of this movie about an hour ago.
Okay.
This is directed by Rupert Wyatt, and it is a sort of dystopian future in which the alien invasion has happened, and there is sort of a war on the streets between government factions who are ostensibly working for the aliens to break up rebel alliances. I'm just speaking in Star Wars terms. rebel factions on the Earth who are resistance, they call themselves, and they like pass each other messages through rolled up cigarettes and that kind of stuff, and they have like cyanide capsules they're gonna eat if they're caught by the aliens or whatever. And I think that this is, you know, Rupert Wyatt's sort of attempt at telling a big invasion film on a really, really small scale. I think he wants to kind of keep this more sort of intimate and within this very small group of people. We rarely actually see the aliens. They show up, I think, all three times in the film, once in a sort of prologue in the beginning of the movie, and then we see them a couple more times. But for the most part, it has less to do with the aliens. The aliens are just sort of a context for this more sort of social science fiction dystopia.
You're, I think, leaving out a key part to that, and that's it was an alien invasion that happened, but that we surrendered, and our government is actively like working with the aliens
with the aliens. So, you know, the sort of the FBI and CIA and all of these kind of groups and military are now, you know, alien bootlickers.
Mm-hmm.
And we only kind of get bits and pieces of how this alliance operates and like what is the terms of this this takeover. Is it just down to the United States? Is it global, worldwide? And we see it all through the perspective of John Goodman's character, who plays one of these sort of agents or police officers who now works for alien undergovernment, who's, you know, working to try and find all of these different resistors as they're running around, you know, trying to sabotage different things in and around downtown Chicago, where most of this is happening. Yeah, what did you think?
This movie was kind of a journey for me.
A journey?
I'll let's see if we had a similar journey.
Okay.
So this
movie, how much did you know about this movie going in, first of all? Because I knew nothing. I didn't even know what it was about.
I knew it was kind of an alien invasion-y thing, and I knew John Goodman was in it, and that's about it.
Okay.
So, where to start? I'll just start with my journey. I'll start with my journey, and then we'll go from there. This has a really baller cold open. The opening sequences, I was like fucking in. I was just holy shit. That's super badass. And then the movie starts. And it's sort of so fucking dense, and there's not really any entry point of explanation or so, like, there's a lot of stuff that just happens, and I'm like, okay, like, this, what is this supposed to mean something to me? And it's just, it feels like an hour of just gibberish, and I'm lost. I get bored. I almost start to fall asleep. Like, I just don't give a fuck. There's a sequence that is so generic and cheesy, like when these underground members, not cheesy, but when these underground members are like signaling each other, and we don't know who any of these characters are.
So many characters.
They literally even establish, like, we don't know who each other are. And then it, like, goes through sort of their way of signaling each other. I almost laughed because it's, like, it's ridiculous. It goes on for a really long time, and they're just showing characters you don't know doing stuff you don't understand.
Right.
And it's such a long sequence, too, that I was like, okay, like, everyone's involved. I get it. But then after they sort of trigger their plan, I start to get back into it slowly, and by the end of it I was like, all right. And I came to this place of never fully liking it, but appreciating it. And yeah, I think that they just needed, I don't know, some kind of entry point into this world, because it's clear that whoever wrote this has their whole mythology mapped out,
right?
But they never let you know what the rules are. They never let you know who the players are. The only real constant you have is John Goodman and in Ashton Sanders as Gabriel Drummond. But even him, you're like a little in the weeds with,
right,
because he has this brother who's like a revolutionary or blah, blah, blah. And even just talking about it, I'm getting bored.
Right. Yeah, I can't say that I liked much of this movie. I think the first scene, the first sequence, is the best sequence, and it's kind of all downhill from
definitely
there.
Definitely. I definitely agree with you there.
I get what Rupert's going for. I think he's kind of going for...
He's going for a lot.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is... He's seen a lot of sort of invasion movies, and he's doing his take on it. But there's like a lot of kind of like Children of Men-ish type stuff going on in here. He wants to create this sort of sense of chaos throughout the movie, and you know, the sort of gang violence, and sort of he's trying to create sort of these political analogies that I don't think work most of the time.
And that's what I'm talking about. Like, there's so much, like, there's this invasion movie aspect of it. There's this political thriller aspect of it. There's this class war aspect of it.
Yeah.
There's this allegories to like the Underground Railroad going on there.
Sure.
It's just like sort of too much.
And the movie never, in whatever it is, an hour and 40 minutes, never really settles on any of it.
Is that all it is?
It feels like a four hour long movie. And what it felt like to me as I was watching it is it felt like it was a movie that you're watching on TV, but only half paying attention to and changing the channel and then like missing a scene or two and going back. And then and you're like, I missed three scenes, so I'm still not sure what's going on, but maybe this is good. I don't know. And that's what it feels like as you're watching the movie. It felt like maybe, I don't know, I'm going to wonder if there's like half a movie sitting somewhere on someone's cutting room floor because they wanted to.
I think
because it's so breathless, and I get that there's sort of a big reveal towards the third act, and
which
and
I knew there would be a reveal. I actually sort of predicted a different twist.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, oh, okay, like within the first 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, okay, this is what's actually going on. It turned out I was wrong, and so maybe that's one of the reasons it sort of won me back a little, was I was like, oh, all right, okay.
Yeah, so because of that, he's holding his stuff and plot stuff, and even world-building stuff, kind of close to his chest, because he wants to sort of fan these out in such a specific way, and it's supposed to all kind of come together.
Give us something.
Yeah, but the problem is we have a bunch of characters that we don't know or care about. We have a bunch of chase scenes. I mean, the majority of the film is mostly identical looking chase scenes. The movie has no style. It's shot
it's unnecessarily grim.
It's very dour. And
not unnecessarily, but there's nothing sort of attracting us to any of these characters. They're just sort of miserable people in a miserable world. And
right. And I think that you could do a movie like this where you have all of these sort of interested parties and they all have their own agendas or whatever. And maybe there's some double cross, triple cross, whatever. That could all be very interesting. There is something to be had with the plot elements, but the way that it's edited together is mostly nonsensical. Any given scene could be anywhere in the movie and it wouldn't make a difference. It's just insanely boring. I found this movie to be, it's so nonstop nonsense action blah that really connect to any of it.
And there's zero stakes because I don't know who any of these people are.
It's just random homeless looking people running around, getting things injected into them and talking to people. I don't know who they are, why they're there or what the plan is. And I don't really understand like this, like governmental structure that's happening.
No,
the closest we get to fully understanding like the gravity or the size of this invasion and it's total infiltration is when they go to a big sporting event and we see the person doing a national anthem to the aliens.
But that's so frustrating because that was kind of a cool sequence.
Right.
But there was no build up to it, so no. I didn't care. Like, I didn't know.
And no climax like to it either. It's like we entered into what seemed like was going to be a big set piece, and then it's like the movie got concerned about budget or something, and all of a sudden we're in little corridors doing more, like, you know, on foot chases.
Yeah, it was like a heist movie where you don't see the plan.
Yeah.
Because they're just like, all right, we're gonna be there then, and we're gonna do this thing, and it's gonna do a thing. And I'm like, okay, like,
what's the thing?
Yeah. Why do I?
What am I looking for in this scene? Like, who am I waiting for? Somebody to pass something to somebody? I don't. And I guess we're supposed to be invested in John Goodman and, like, Vera Farmiga and, like, whatever's going on there. I'm not really.
Are we?
John Goodman is, you know, one of my favorite actors, and he's kind of sleepwalking through this movie.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's such a waste of such a talented cast. We've got John Goodman. We've got Vera Farmiga. We've got Kevin Dunn. We've got Alan Ruck. Mm-hmm. Where's Alan Ruck been? I was like, once I realized that was Alan Ruck, I was like, come on. Give me some of the Ruck.
bring the ruckus. Machine Gun Kelly, if you're there for him. Actually, you know what's sad? Machine Gun Kelly kind of stood out in this movie.
Yeah.
Because at least he seems like he's happy to be there.
He's at least a distinguishable character.
Yeah. And Ashton Sanders, who was great in Moonlight, was fucking amazing in Moonlight, is kind of bad in this.
I don't think he's bad. I mean,
he's given garbage dialogue, but still.
Yeah, I was never, like, out on him. I was just, it was, to me, the movie was not doing him any favors.
No.
It was, yeah.
So, we're big sci-fi nerds. What did you think of the aliens? Like, you know, just on creature effects and that kind of stuff. Do we like the aliens? They never really settled on a design, first of all.
And as soon as we see them, there's... Again, during that first sequence, I was like, ooh, I don't know what I'm looking at. That's kind of cool. Mm. And then it comes back, and I was like, so the sort of initial design, I wanted to understand it because I thought the design was cool enough.
Right.
And it sort of has like these
kind of otherworldly. It's not like a gray or a slimy thing or a tentacle-y thing.
It's like it has these hairs, but the hairs can become spikes. So I was like, it's kind of like a Shadow Man death urchin.
Sure.
And so that design I was pretty cool on.
Yeah.
But then it introduces these other aliens, these other versions of these aliens, these hunters.
Which pretty much look like Predator.
But like shitty Predator. Like shitty sci-fi movie version. Like they don't look like Predator. They look like Elite Hunter, and they're called
the
Hunters.
Mockbuster version of it. Yeah,
like they look really cheesy. And the other so one creature design I thought was mysterious and cool, but I wanted to know more about it. Like one of them gets killed in a way that makes me think it is this their like spacesuit. I don't know. So, one design I thought was cool, one design I thought was garbage, and it really frustrated me that they abandoned that to show these other aliens as, like, the sort of peak badass aliens, but they look just really shitty and dumb.
Right.
So that was actually pretty frustrating.
Yeah.
This movie felt like someone saw District 9 and was like, ooh, I'm going to do that, but like my version of that.
Like District 9 meets Children of Men.
Yeah, but without
anything that makes either of those movies interesting.
Yeah, none of the fun of District 9 and none of the intellect of Children of Men.
No, it kind of, honestly, it feels like something that should have been direct-to-DVD. Or like a direct to Netflix kind of event. Like it feels underwritten and just like kind of shoddily edited and put together. And it just happens to have a bunch of famous people in it who got tricked into this. I can't say very many positive things about it other than at least it's an original property. And so, you know, that's cool that they tried. But honestly, this feels like something that should have come out in January or February.
It is kind of a dump. Like I said, it almost wins me back at the end once I start to get some semblance of who these characters were. But it's definitely too little too late.
Way, way too much.
Like, had they sort of revealed that in the first 20 minutes?
Just something.
Like, give us this so we know who the characters are, and then maybe I'll give a shit about...
Give us some center of consciousness in the movie. I mean, John Goodman's kind of that. Like, if there is somebody who sort of anchors all this, it's him, but not nearly enough. And he's not, very likable or warm character.
And it's... This movie is just building to a twist, and that's right. A problem.
And not a very good one.
It should have just been a short film. it should have just been the opening sequence, roll credits...
Right.
Here's a grant for your next movie.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it wasn't good.
No. I'm going to give this a C-, and I feel like I'm being overly generous, actually.
I don't know. I think C- is fair. Like, I wouldn't have been mad if I had caught it on TV, like you said, and switched channels between.
Right.
Yeah, I'll say C-. I'll match you.
Okay.
I think that's pretty accurate.
All right. Keith, describe to me, when we're going to be talking about our Netflix homework now, 2009's The Informant, which I assigned you last week. Describe to me what happens in that movie.
So Matt Damon is playing Mark Whitaker. He works for corn business,
a big
right,
yeah, a big
big
corn syrup corporation.
Yeah, he has evidence that this corn corporation is using illegal practices to fix prices, mm-hmm. To drive up the market value. He turns it over to the FBI. They want him to be an inside informant. He sort of then starts playing the FBI against this company and this company against the FBI. And I mean, he lies a whole bunch to everybody. That's sort of this movie, is just Matt Damon lying to everyone for 2 hours, making everything worse for everybody.
Right. Over the course of, in the film, I think a 3-year period, as this investigation
I think it's like 5 years.
Yeah. This all takes place in like the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And I think, is this based on a true story, or I'm unsure of that actually. Because there's like a postscript at the end.
It definitely felt like it was.
Or could have been. Yeah.
Yeah. So... to be honest, I did have sort of trouble keeping up with all of the sort of plot points of like who he was lying to when and why and that sort of thing. And I do think the movie sort of does that intentionally.
Uh-huh.
I think the movie sort of can't keep up with all of the lies and stuff that the character's telling, to sort of purposely take you off guard. But basically, Matt Damon is like this lying buffoon, goofball con man to every one of my favorite comedians playing straight man.
It's kind of true, yeah. I mean, this is speaking of casts.
Yeah, Murderers Row. You've got Tom Papa. You've got Joe McHale. You've got Patton Oswalt. You've even got my boy Paul F. Tompkins in here.
Tony Hale.
Tony Hale. Yeah. And all of them are just sort of like
Rick Overton.
Their whole job. Rick Overton. I did a workshop with Rick Overton.
Oh, yeah.
And every one of them just sort of like has to look at Matt Damon and just go, oh, boy, just tell the truth.
You know, not a famous comedian per se, but probably one of my favorite Scott Bakula performances.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, I was definitely into Scott Bakula in this.
Yeah, I always enjoy
Scott
when he...
Scott Adsit is in this.
Mm-hmm. Melanie Lynskey playing his wife.
Another comedian who I love. Andy Daly has a small cameo. Literally, like, just an insanely talented comedy cast.
Yeah.
To the point that it's a little frustrating that it's not more of a comedy. It is. I mean, it's pretty funny for a lot of it.
I think it is mostly intended to be a comedy, sort of a comedy of errors. It isn't a knee slapper. It's not like a hysterical, like setup punchline kind of comedy. It's a character study.
It's quirky,
essentially.
Yeah, it's comedy in the way that any Steven Soderbergh movie is a comedy.
Sure. When he decides to make comedies. Yes.
Yeah.
It's understated.
Yeah. Honestly, I kind of had a hard time with a lot of this movie, though.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had sort of similar problems to this as I did Captive State. I sort of had trouble keeping up with the actual story. I do think this has more character to sort of hang your hat on.
Yeah.
And I really like Matt Damon. This is a great performance for him.
Yeah.
And I think his narration adds a lot to it. I like what the movie's going for, but it's just to show you sort of like this character who sort of can't keep up with his own brain.
Right.
Who can't keep up with him, his own lies and his own, it's just a compulsion.
Yeah.
And I think there is some fun in that. But again, I sort of didn't know exactly what he was lying about when and to who.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think those choices were intentional, but it made it a little less, I think, watchable.
Going back to when I originally was talking about this, when I reviewed this, you know, 10 years ago for my little YouTube show back then, I had similar issues with it. It was And in a way, this kind of like reminds me of The Big Lebowski or certain films like that, where there's so much going on in the plot that you kind of get lost trying to connect the dots, where you're like, well, wait a minute. So are these guys actually doing something illegal, or is he making this up too? Where is he of this? And you know, what exactly is his end game here? What part is he lying about? What part is truth? And
I think that's
get so
totally
mired.
Intentional.
Right. No, totally. I think you get so mired in just trying to connect the dots because our brains are designed to take in story that way that on a second viewing, it worked a lot more for me because I just sort of let off the gas on that stuff and just let that stuff happen, most of which I've forgotten. So I was able to sort of experience it new again. Other than the basics of what the plot is. And I just, the second time around, I was able to just kind of go, okay, I know he's lying about everything, pretty much.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't, you know, work out very well for him. But so let's just enjoy the ride and let's just look at, you know, sort of the idiosyncrasies of the characters and that kind of stuff. And that's when I fell into the vibe of this movie a lot more. And I think, you know, the big experiment that Soderbergh is playing with this movie is it's a movie from the perspective of an unreliable narrator. And so...
Yeah, definitely. Not only an unreliable narrator, but a narrator who you know is going... It's not unreliable in that it's a character withholding information or it is building on some sort of big lie.
Uh-huh.
I think it's an experiment to see if you can follow a character who you literally can't trust a word out of their mouth.
Right. And you're all, but I do think you are kind of seeing it from his perspective too, because there you could tell the story in a more conventional way where, you know, there's more of an omniscient perspective where we know the actual truth of the matter in one scene, then go back and see him lie. And then that would be more, a more sort of traditional way of telling this sort of comedy setup. Whereas instead, the more experimental mind of Steven Soderbergh, he wants to say, he wants us to see it through his eyes. It's a character who literally believes his own lies because he's, he's that deep in it that he, you know, he's essentially doing like secret extortion through most of the movie, but he has to justify to himself why it's okay to do this.
And yes, definitely. And I appreciated that aspect of it, but it's also sort of like, can you think like a crazy person? Like, can you get into the, it's, and I think that's why this movie's challenging is because you can't, you can't. And so you're trying to hold all the pieces together, just like this character is.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the experiment of it. And I do.
We think, are Joe McHale and Scott Bakula in the movie, the audience.
Yes.
Where we're only getting bits and pieces of information. And we're going, wait, what?
Definitely. And I think there are some great straight man performances of like just people exasperated.
Totally fed up with him. Yeah.
Yeah. I think maybe, you know, and it does have sort of the slickness of that Steven Soderbergh direction.
Yeah. I mean, everything's sort of amber lit and, you know, very carefully composed and shot.
It is much more watchable than Captain
It's a good-looking movie.
Yeah, and it is, if you like character performances and you like nuanced performances, it's worth watching. I think it might be a little overlong.
Maybe a little.
Because the way the character's brain works, like, at a point in time, I got sick of it. I was like, okay.
Yeah. There's a little stretch in the middle there where it kind of slogs a bit, and I also think that the soundtrack or the score is a little insistent sometimes with like the happy go lucky like whistly like do 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 like kind of stuff. I was like, all right, I get it. He's like a cornball. This is like a Ned Flanders looking.
Well,
you know,
I don't think it's that. I think it's
maybe that's the
like
whistling in his own head.
Yeah, I think it's like this. I got it, but I think there is a point in time where the movie starts to spin its own wheels in the mud a little bit, and you're not really getting anything new out of it,
right?
And that's when it started to wear out its welcome to an already challenging movie,
right?
So I didn't love it, but I did. I appreciated it more than I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think same here. I did enjoy it more the second time. I'll say that. I watched it over like the course of like 3 days, like in pieces. But I kind of now knowing what I needed to know and having more sort of grounding in the plot stuff, I was able to appreciate more of just sort of the surface weirdness of it all. And sort of the experimental nature of the movie. So I like this movie. I'll go ahead and say I like it. But it is challenging, and I think it's intentionally so, and maybe some people will not fully get the rewards of that
that's
challenge.
I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing that it's challenging, especially if you're a fan of Steven Soderbergh. I think there's enough to chew on, and there are so many like fun performances that I think it's worth your time if you're up to the challenge.
Yeah.
But I think it does help going into it sort of expecting that.
What is hilarious is if you ever get a chance, go to YouTube and look up Paul F. Tompkins on Conan O'Brien, I believe, talking about his experience on the set, having lunch with Matt Damon. He tells a very funny story about that. So go go back and look at that.
He has some great stories. His
There Will Be Blood stories.
Yeah, yeah. His album Laboring Under Delusions, he has a really good story with Daniel Day-Lewis and Tom Cruise. Mm. A couple really good stories there. So
yeah,
check those out.
But yeah, I recommend the movie, but it is unconventional. So what do you have for me next week?
For next week's Netflix homework, I am challenging you with another film experiment, Hardcore Henry. This is an action movie from a few years back, all based in the first person.
Yes. From a first person perspective.
We'll see how that goes. Yeah, it's a first person shooter movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Hardcore Henry.
Hardcore Henry. All right. If anybody has anything to say about any of the movies we talked about here, go ahead and email our old email address at jabrondrone@gmail.com. I'm going to make a new one for this podcast. I just have yet to do that. But if you do have opinions and you want to share your thoughts on the stuff we talked about, jabrondrone@gmail.com. But also, you can contact us on Facebook at facebook.com/MacGuffinPod. You can find us on social medias at Instagram at MacGuffinPod and Twitter at MacGuffinPod. What else? You can follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy. You can also read my writing that I've done for the Idaho State Journal. Look up Idaho State Journal Cassidy Robinson. You should see some of my reviews. Click on that. You'll see the rest of my reviews. And also read the writing that I've done as a contributor to the MacGuffin website at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. And while you're on the website, be sure to check out all of the other reviews and articles that are being, written every week by the wonderful contributors over at Seattle's The MacGuffin. Listen to us and stream us on Stitcher Radio and iTunes so far.
Please rate and review.
Yes, please rate and review us. If you've been enjoying what you're hearing here, leave a 5-star review and a sentence or two about what we do. I'm rapping, so that's new.
Hmm. Oh, and you're still doing it. You're still going.
I'm in a rap loop. yes, please review us on Stitcher or iTunes. And I'm going to try and get a Player.fm and Pocket Cast and Google Play and hopefully Spotify.
We're still building it up, yeah. So be patient.
Yes.
We'll get on your favorite player.
Here pretty soon. So what about you, Keith? What's your stuff?
Follow me. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, for upcoming show dates. I've always got a couple loaded in the pipe. If you're in the San Diego area, please come check it out. It means a lot to me. You can also follow me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram at Keith Foster Kid.
All right. Just that?
Feels, yeah, I'm
so
to,
abridged.
I'm trying. I'm trying to shorten this part of the podcast up because it's like real long.
It is. We have.
And they're like, most people have probably just
tuned out by now. If you're still with us, tweet us and say still with you, at still with you.
Oh, no, hashtag still with you.
Yes. listen to the other podcasts of friends of ours who do their own podcasts, including Patrick, who sent us a voicemail today at Almost Educational with his friend Dennis. Listen to Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums podcast. Listen to Alice and Buddy over at Those Happy Places and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast. And check out Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought. And I believe that is the end of the show.
Give us the ruck. That might be the new Give It to Gosling is raise a ruckus. I don't know how to... People will know specifically that it's Alan Ruck. Maybe we don't give no Alan Rucks. For now, raise a ruckus will do.
Bye.